ravi de vous accueillir pour cette nouvelle séance du séminaire Erivia. Nous avons la joie d'accueillir aujourd'hui un intervenant extérieur à l'Université de Caen qui nous vient, qui plus est, de l'étranger. Welcome, Daisy. Je vous souhaite de passer un bon moment et laisse la parole sans attendre à notre modératrice Anne-Catherine Rouvier.
Merci Bertrand. So I'll be introducing Daisy in English, which makes sense since the conference is in English. And I'm delighted to introduce today's guest in the seminar on the theme of memory and oblivion, organized by the Erivia Research Group. Daisy Wilkinson is a performer of Irish traditional music, as you can see for yourself and as you shall hear shortly, as a singer and as a flute player. So we'll hear him in this capacity later tonight as well. And this event, tonight's event, is scheduled at 6 p.m., provided we have no further legal difficulties with the organization of the concert. Back to more academic concerns. Daisy has written Music in Ireland and Music Among the Irish Diaspora. His latest work is concerned with a slightly different area. It's entitled Call to the Dance. It was published in 2016, and it offers a unique perspective on the world of social dance music in Brittany. And there are indeed strong links between Ireland and Brittany, as we discussed earlier on. And I hope this will help us leave us aside for a moment the old feud between Normandy and Brittany. Between 2004 and 2015, Daisy lectured in traditional music and ethnomusicology at Newcastle University in England. Daisy is currently back in Ireland, and he's traditional artist in residence at Mary Immaculate College, University of Limerick. Daisy had already been in Caen and had taken part in a conference on music in Ireland organised some years ago by Thierry Dubost and Alexandra Slaby. I'd missed the conference and only met Daisy last June, as he was artist in residence at the Centre Culturel Irlandais in Paris. Needless, I suppose, to point to the links between music and memory, so I thought it would be a good idea to invite Daisy to give a lecture in this seminar. And he will be talking about his personal journey towards the formation of an aesthetic in traditional music. As to the main title of this paper, Play Me a Lonesome Reel, this is a mystery which I am sure will shortly be unraveled.
I hope so. Thank you, Anne-Catherine. I'd like to thank everybody here at the University of Caen. It's a real pleasure for me to be here again, the second time in this beautiful city. And I'm very, very honoured by the invitation, and very, you know, happy to have met Anne-Catherine this summer, and that led to me coming here. So apart from that, you know, welcome. Nice to meet you all. I'll be speaking in English. I'm assuming that you're all fluent in English. So if you want me to slow down, make a sign, and I'll attempt to slow down, because Irish people are notorious, for those of you who know Ireland, for speaking English very fast. That's because our minds are very active, you know. So anyway, and we're known for our imaginations. So if I go off on a tangent during this lecture, you will forgive me. I could end up in Outer Mongolia, because that's what we do. Anyway, so I'll stick to my script. I'll read to stop myself going away from the point. And at the end, I'll talk for about an hour, around about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour. And after that, if you want to ask me questions, I'm very happy to attempt to answer them. So I think the best way for me to start is to play a tune, because I'm much safer as a flute player than a speaker. So I'll just play a little tune called The Happy Days of Easter, because I know that Christmas is being celebrated already. Our current society, we've got to keep celebrating things that are happening way in advance. So I'm going to start to celebrate Easter now rather than Christmas, because Christmas clearly is too close. So this tune is called The Happy Days of Easter. hope this doesn't cause a problem. Thank you very much. Well, I'll just read out the sort of the abstract that I've written here that should go some way towards contextualizing what I'm going to say. My first memory, to go back to what Anne-Catherine was saying, of hearing the word lonesome, it's an unusual word, in connection with music, was in County Mayo over 30 years ago. I was in a pub and just placed this flute case or something like it on the bar when a voice behind me intoned, and sort of, if you say intoned in English, you mean speaks in low, in a low voice, play me one of those old lonesome reels. So I didn't think much about the word lonesome, but I sort of knew what it meant. I knew what he meant. I knew that lonesome didn't mean sad necessarily. I knew that it didn't mean happy either. I knew that it meant a state of mind that was reflective and philosophical in some way, and about the human condition. Not to get too complicated about it, but it's a word that's part of the normal vocabulary when we speak of traditional music, folk music in Ireland, and it seems to me not sad, not happy, but just reflective about the nature of human existence. So I played the tune, and he bought me a pint of Guinness, and I regard that as a huge success. So by reference to my first experiences of involvement with old music, let's just call it old music, without really speculating or attempting to explain how old it is, whether it's 5th century, before Christ, or 20 years ago, let's not even go there. Let's just use this phrase, old music, for the moment. I want to talk about the beginning of my, I suppose, experience of traditional music in Belfast. I'm from Belfast, and I'll say the two phrases which are very key to understanding someone from Belfast in the political sense, in a socio-political way. Belfast is in the north of Ireland. Then again, Belfast is in Northern Ireland. Now, those two very subtle ways of explaining the location of Belfast. It's not the geographical location, it's a socio-political location. And by using the north of Ireland, I'm declaring my hand as a nationalist or a republican. And by using Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland, I'm more or less saying I accept Northern Ireland's position within the British, the UK system, and I'm saying that I'm British. But that has evolved a little bit. I'm sorry to preamble this a bit, but it is sort of curious and interesting. And I suppose it's a matter of other types of research that I'm still involved in. So I have to get it off my chest first and foremost. Like most people, to get back to the music, I've taken, and think about yourselves in this one as well, I've taken several different formative pathways, usually involving actual as well as metaphorical travel. And this is, in the sense of this talk, to do with music. All of which have affected the way I have experienced music and social life. What I'd like to talk about here is one of these significant routes, to revisit some of the little switches that ignite the imaginary and allow us to make connections along the way, or, if you like, disconnections. I'm basically looking for a sonic home place, somewhere where I feel at home, sonically. Telling a story to come to terms with the past. It's a personal story. I'm trying to understand why I thought about certain things and musical expressions at certain points in my life in a certain way. Why I almost, on some occasions, turned off, or listened to things with a political ear rather than an aesthetic ear. So it's, you know, I was brought up in an old working class area of Belfast, very near the city centre, called the Armour Road, the Lower Armour Road. I lived there during a period stretching from the late 1950s until the late 1970s, a time frame that includes some of the most intensely depressing periods of what has come to be known as the Troubles, or more specifically, the Northern Troubles, to differentiate them from 1916 and 1921. Belfast at that time was the epicenter of this bitter conflict, a conflict between Unionist and Republican, Catholic and Protestant. That's a bit more complex, but nonetheless, I'll use those terms. That was set to continue until the early 1990s and the resolution, well, the quasi-revolution that has now been brought into question yet again by Brexit, the peace process and the peace talks. So it's still very much a process, and the event, the fact that the UK voted for Brexit has made our situation in Ireland rather precarious yet again. Thank you, the UK. So Belfast was the epicenter of this bitter conflict, a conflict that was set to continue into the early 1990s, and which still has considerable resonance today, unfortunately. During the 1970s, most parts of working-class Belfast were shadowy urban landscapes, where sectarian strife and identity politics were never far below the surface, with people identifying themselves as British or Irish, even though they had the same accent and very often the same life experience. However, in spite of the ominous sense of foreboding that was a silent witness to what was unfolding and the difficult socio-political environment there was, nonetheless, a vibrant vernacular musical scene in the city. Jazz, rock, traditional folk music featured strongly in this world of music as well. When I recall the ambience of the music sessions I attended in Belfast during the 1970s, my abiding memory is of camaraderie, music, banter, and conversations rich in philosophical anecdote and humour, which we refer to in Ireland as the having the crack, which elsewhere in the English language world means something, crack means something entirely different. So from this perspective, they were good times indeed. I was young, and for me they were and remain, in spite of the environment of the Troubles, the happy days of youth. Playing traditional music and singing folk songs in the city of Belfast was then, and remains, a non-sectarian, relatively non-mainstream, so you could say countercultural activity. Even though Ireland is known as a place where traditional folk music is played all over the place and you can find sessions in pubs the length and breadth of the country, it's a vernacular, popular expression, but it is nonetheless still a minority sport, and most people will still be more touched by mainstream events in big stadiums like anywhere else to do with rock music generally. So we're talking about a popular vernacular that is nonetheless still a minority sport. I can't recall any particular sense of class consciousness or of a shared ethnicity or anything like that among the participants. The social organization around sessions of music was generally ad hoc. It's since changed in people playing in pubs in Ireland now, and usually two musicians are booked to play and they're paid to be there. At this time in the 1980s, it wasn't like that. There was very little economy or local economy associated with playing folk music. You just went out and played and there was no money involved. Now it's slightly changed. Despite this element of cloak and dagger activity, finding out where the session was, once ensconced in a suitable place, all the music sessions that I remember were sort of noisy and joyful type of affairs. Much like anywhere else in Ireland, sessions usually took place in the back rooms of pubs. social clubs, or in the kitchens of private houses. And the main part of the repertory played was what I've just played for you there, a piece of dance music, interspersed on occasion with a song or two. Dancing itself rarely formed part of the evening's entertainment in this context. The particularity of the Belfast scene was that sessions were usually located within a patchwork quilt of areas and specific pubs perceived to be safe. Safe, because remember, at that time, there was bombs everywhere and sectarian assassinations and, you know, it was a very, very tense time. It's hard for people to appreciate sometimes, unless you've lived in a war zone, like Beirut or perhaps Bosnia or Sarajevo. That's the only places I can think of, even though it's a smaller scale, and I have to admit that. Belfast never got as bad as Sarajevo. It still had elements of the Sarajevo situation in it, where you did feel on occasion when you went out in the evening that your life could be in danger. So it wasn't a nice feeling. And that's the sort of a background to this type of scenario, if you like. A safe place meant somewhere where the music played and the song sung, although they were mostly apolitical in nature, would not be a potential cause for friction. In more public central occasions, if the songs and tunes were described as or perceived to be Irish, just use the word Irish, I-R-I-S-H, that itself may have been enough to upset someone within the Unionist or for the most part Protestant community. Even to say this is an Irish song, not everybody, but it may have upset somebody. So people were very, very careful. Very careful. I mean, I remember all over Northern Ireland, there was in a lot of bars in the central towns that weren't in, you know, specifically Unionist or Republican areas. There was signs up on the door, and there still is. Do not wear, and this is actually topical because I'm just thinking of the 7-1 defeat that Paris Saint-Germain inflicted on Glasgow Celtic last night, an aside. But in Northern Ireland, Glasgow Celtic and Glasgow Rangers are affiliated to the Republican and Unionist communities. So simply wearing a football shirt that in normal circumstances may just say, I'm a supporter of Glasgow Rangers, I'm a supporter of Glasgow Celtic, it marked you out as a Republican or a loyalist. So wearing these football shirts in the centre of Belfast or Derry or public places is prohibited, not by law, but by the social action of proprietors of pubs and restaurants. So it's just an interesting aside. I wish Paris Saint-Germain beat Rangers, sorry. Anyway, as a result of this consideration, by strategic default, most of the safe, regular public access places for sessions came to be found in nationalist or Republican, for the most part, Catholic, working class areas of the city. Protestant and probably Unionist people participated regularly in these events, however. They were non-sectarian, and people who liked the music, even if they didn't call it Irish music, they might have said, oh, I play folk music. They were nonetheless involved in the aesthetic of the music without avoiding potential descriptors that would leave it as to be described as British or Irish. They were making a conscious effort to concentrate on the aesthetic qualities of the expression. So that was quite a common thing. I mean, just, I play folk music. I might have said that too. Rather, and I still feel uncomfortable saying, well, I play Irish music, because I might, putting in ethnicity on a music like that, to my mind, devalues the aesthetic quality of it in some cases, you know. So even though it's sensible from an economic point of view to describe the music I play as Irish or Celtic or something, it's still somewhere about me and others like me, as a musician, I find that I'd rather be seen as a musician, as somebody who expresses myself in a musical way that is not necessarily associated strongly with an ethnicity. But that's another passing point that, you know, probably requires a paper in itself. So probably events like the ones I attended were happening in Protestant working class areas of Belfast. I just wasn't aware of them. I didn't experience them. That's not to say they didn't exist. The sessions themselves were like little explosions of excited bonhomie, musicians sitting around a table. Beer was involved, usually. In many ways, they were a release from the sheer tension of what was going on in the wider society. Arguably in Belfast at that time, Northern Ireland more broadly defined, or north of Ireland, take your pick, arguably to go out and socialise at all in the type of atmosphere that pretend was a triumph in itself. So going to a session in another part of town sometimes meant having to stay there for the night in that area, even if getting home may have only involved a half an hour walk. Careful planning was involved. Travelling by car or taxi was the best plan, but this was easier said than done for many young people in the 1970s because very few people owned cars. It was quite difficult. You had to pool your resources. And then if you phoned a taxi service, it had to be somebody prepared to go to a certain area. It was very, very, or if you didn't know the taxi service, you could have been picked up by a potential gang of assassins. There was advice in the newspapers every night about how to avoid being dragged into a car and taken away and murdered. So that was in the newspapers. So that type of thing, even if that was, in retrospect, a bit of overextending, if you like, that metaphor of feeling that sort of level of danger, it was still a precaution that was out there, that you don't do this, do this. Take taxis places, make sure you know the taxi driver. If somebody pulls up beside you in a car and you're walking in the road, run over to the far side of the car, because run to the driver's side, because the passenger is the person going to shoot you. So this was the type of advice young people in Belfast, especially young men, were reading. It was part of your. I've avoided the psychiatric hospital just to now. I hope I will continue to avoid it. But these things do stay embedded in your memory, that you didn't have to go to a gym then. You just ran about everywhere. You were a very good runner. You were a marathon runner. There were lots of very good sporty people, just because that's what you had to be in your day-to-day life. So I also have a vivid memory of the spectacle of musicians sitting in a circle, playing music, absorbed in the music, sharing bar space with a British Army patrol that just came in with all their faces black, combat gear, and they looked into everybody's face. Looked around, and they looked at people the same age as them. I've spent 15 years of my life in England, and I've met people now that were members of the British Army in Belfast, and these were young working class guys from the big cities in England who had no jobs, and they were there, and they didn't know what was going on. They had no idea why people hated them in certain places, or they had no idea, because still people in England, I think, I don't think they get an education about history. I just don't think so. Certainly not imperial history, or they'd all be running around crying all the time. Anyway, so that's another thing to throw out there and think about. So the soldiers had just come in to look around and make sure nobody was carrying guns or whatever they were doing. And they looked, they listened, and they left. But it was still surreal. It was like people occupying parallel worlds, different dimensions. It's unreal, because the people in the pub ignored them, or did their best to ignore them. They said, "You're not going to stop us. You know, we're going to continue with our normal life. You're the people that don't belong here. You're invisible." So it was a very strange and odd experience. So anyway, I was a young guy in Belfast, and another significant part of that broad soundscape of traditional music in Belfast, still very much a part of things today, was that of the marching bands. Now, the better marching bands, the more musical ones, I have to say, belong to the loyalist Protestant community, the unionist community. They're the ones, they've been doing it for years. They commemorate the Battle of Boyne, 1690, defeat of James II, and the Williamite cause, the Protestant people. The establishment of the Protestant ascendancy in Ireland dates to 1690, and that's what mostly working class people in Northern Ireland I'll use Northern Ireland in this context, celebrate. They celebrate this, and this marching band tradition is part of their folklore, part of their expression of traditional music. And I know people within that world who may not go out and say, I like Irish music in so many words, but they're very well capable of playing it, and they understand the aesthetic very well. So it's, we're not looking at a situation here where that is simple, where there's two groups of people playing different forms of folk music. It's much more complex than that. It's actually, but it can't be sort of publicly acknowledged very often, even now. So these bands, these working class bands of young men usually, but now young women are getting involved, they're a very raw and ready sound. They're paramilitaristic people dressed in paramilitary uniforms, basically. Nowadays, the loyalist bands tend to be, after the peace process kicked in, much more like, they resemble more American marching bands, like majorettes and for frilly costumes and bright colors. And, you know, they're not as sinister as they were in my youth in the 1970s and 80s. They're much more, but they're less interesting. I much prefer the rough and ready bands that I grew up, that frightened the life out of me at the time, but nonetheless intrigued me. And I used to secretly, because you couldn't not be insensitive to it, you couldn't secretly hear the bands and the drums in the backgrounds and go, oh yeah, I want to go and see it, but I can't because I'm in the other camp. I can't go and enjoy this because, for political reasons. You used to hear, and one, the bands in the distance, the drums, and I actually, as a kid, went to all the 12th of July parades just until I was 13 years old in Belfast, just to look, and the bands that I waited for were these bands called Blood and Thunder. Blood and Thunder bands, because they really believed what they were doing. They were beating out sectarian hatred on one level, with big drums, lots of noise, till the drums smashed. And they were singing anti-Catholic songs and kill the Pope and drag him off and I don't know, all this stuff, you know. That's a polite way, by the way. That's one of the polite things. And there was actually, in Belfast, I marched out to the field, a field where all the bands gathered at the end and had, it was like a party ambience on one level, where there was festive chips and sandwiches and little booths where you could, there was a sort of doll dressed up as the Pope and you could spend five pence and go and kick the Pope. So it was great fun. All the kids were living up to do this, you know. Probably did it myself, but anyway, that was part of the scene. And on the other hand, there was these very stiff, reverential, orange men, as they were called, organization that remember William of Orange and the Battle of the Boyne, 1690. And they were generally very religious and usually talked about, you know, the evils of drink and stuff, while other people ran around with bottles of Guinness. And it was sort of strange, a strange mixture of piety and a sort of festive, you know, bacchanalia. And that's what that was my impression of it at 14, 13, 14, before I was told in no uncertain terms by some of my friends, don't go to that parade anymore. You're either with us or against us. That was the words used. You're with us. You're a Catholic, you're with us, or you're against us. And at that time, I suppose I didn't understand the nuance of it all because I was half Protestant and half, my father's Protestant, my mother Catholic. So I had a line into the Protestant vernacular celebrations, which some of my friends didn't have, I think. And as a result, I sort of saw the humanity behind a lot of the stuff. And I saw that, you know, people aren't inherently evil, you know, they're just getting on with things as they see it. So at that time, when I was 14, 15, I didn't have that luxury of reflection that I've since developed, and that this paper explains in some way, I hope, of hearing things and being pragmatic about what I heard. So anyway, Blood and Thunder bands that we're going to have a look at very shortly. Move on, yes, soon. Now, I won't use the internet for this, but I think I'll have to negotiate somewhere. So I'll have to do something complex. Anyway, the first band you're going to see are a band marching in a town called Newtownards in the early 1980s, in, I think the date might be on it, I think I'm talking about the 1980s, and it'll give you an idea of the sort of profile of the music of the Blood and Thunder band. They usually march for a period of a month up until the 12th of July, which is the commemorative, the day that the Battle of the Boyne was fought in 1690. So you have parades in little towns and villages and all, everywhere in Belfast up until the 12th of July, and then they sort of get a bit less frequent. But quite often these parades are flashpoints because they insist on walking through areas where the majority of the population don't want them. So that causes sectarian strife and riots and lots of stuff. So the Parades Commission in Northern Ireland, in the north of Ireland, have been trying to unravel this difficulty for a long time. It's still there. But anyway, let's see if I can just, ish up should work. Minimize is the next thing I'm going to try to do. Okay, well, I'll say something about that. You have seen the site. So, as I said, I've been to all those parades, or I've seen these type of bands in my youth. And without having any conception of their socio-political baggage at that time, I took particular delight in the sheer, this is a wonderful word, rambunctious spectacle, the wild, raw musical fare that these particular bands provided. It's a very, very visceral sound of the flutes, very rough and ready and wild. Exciting stuff, played with gusto and serious conviction. It's a sight and sound that once heard remains in the memory, I think. So this is the earliest video I could trace, the one we've just seen there. It's from the 1980s, and it's a band called the Royal Crown, and it captures this atmosphere of the Blood and Thunder band. By the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I'd also made several visits, this is to set up the other video that we might look at, to the annual Sham Fight. Now Sham means pretend, or spectacle if you like, like a pantomime fight if you like. Sham Fight, a pageant commemorating the victory of William of Orange over the Catholic King James II at the Boyne in 1690 at a place called Scarva in County Armagh with my father. These are one or two annual pilgrimages I made with him until around 12 years of age. The other one was the Ulster Grand Prix in Dundrod. It's in County Antrim. And this, again, the motorbikes and parades are two things that are very part of vernacular loyalist or unionist working class expression in Northern Ireland. So that's a sort of an interesting thing. In the same way as you might have GAA, Gaelic football, and music sessions or hurling, games, sport, Gaelic sport for the Catholic or Republican community. If you like, these marching bands and motor sports are very much a vernacular expression of working class, again, loyalism, Protestantism in Northern Ireland. And I had a road into that through my own father, because he was involved in that. He was involved in motorbike races when he was a young fella, and he always took me to see the parade on the 12th of July. My mother didn't always approve, but that's what he did. And it was part of, I think what he was trying to do was make me into somebody who's genuinely non-sectarian. And it probably had a good effect in that sense, when I think back on it. It was at the Sham Fight where I first saw and heard lambeg drums, these huge big drums, big military drums that were used by all the European armies in the 17th century. But they're still used in the context of Northern Ireland's unionist community. So that's another one of the things, yeah. Again, no sound. Is that on the internet this time? Let's just look a bit of a spectacle, really.
It does look a bit silly without the sound.
But I mean, anybody who knows Shannos dancing in the Connemara, west of Ireland sense, will recognize some of the moves that this guy is doing. So it's a strange similarities between people who would claim to have no cultural affinity, whatever. So it's a shame we can't get the sound here, but nonetheless, I'll keep on talking for the moment, and we might be able to revisit these videos at the end. It was the age of 13, basically in 1967, just before the dramatic outbreak of the Troubles in Northern Ireland in 1969, that my innocence of the cultural, political realities in Irlanda del Norte, or Irlanda du Nord, because you can say Irlanda du Nord, you can say it in Spanish or French, and it means Northern Ireland or the North of Ireland. So it's, you know, I tend sometimes to use that expression, Irlanda du Nord, or Irlanda del Norte, to sort of explain that there you are, the ambiguity, once you use another language that could be described as Northern Ireland or the North of Ireland, whereby those two phrases in English are loaded in a different geopolitical way. So, as I began to get a handle on the basics of Irish history and my own particular place because of my family circumstances, in its all-consuming wake, the visceral, shrill sounds, which you haven't heard yet, and thumping drums of the Loyalist, Protestant, Unionist, Blood and Thunder marching bands, together with the spectacle of the stick throwing and twirling of their band leaders, and to a lesser extent, the lambeg drums, the big drums and fifes, became almost overnight something I could no longer enjoy or appreciate. Because I had migrated into the community which was nationalist and Republican, by dint of where I lived and by dint of my friends and the school that I went to, and the way I was being brought up as a Catholic. I didn't know at that time, but I'd entered into a period of politically motivated sonic denial. By schooling, as I say, I was a Catholic, and family ties on my mother's side. The Loyalists derisively called us Fenians, in a reference to the 19th century Irish separatist movement, the Fenian Brotherhood, who famously staged attacks on Canada from their US base between 1866 and 1871, in order to pressurize Britain into getting out of Ireland. Fenians did not go to the 12th of July parades or to events like the Sham Fight at Scarva. The Sham Fight celebrated a form of triumphalist Orangism that was anathema to anyone being a Fenian or a Catholic Republican nationalist. I read up on who the Fenians were. I started to study history then. And as a famous old rebel song says, rebel is the word used to describe people who rebelled against the British presence in Ireland. Their cause was a failure. I was nonetheless impressed by the idealism and the glory of this failure, because a lot of the Fenians were nascent socialists, and their sort of nationalism went beyond just nationalism. It was a social nationalism, and that was very much, you know, like travailliste, if you like, labour, or that level. So it was attractive in that sense, and it was reaching out to Protestant and dissenter in Ireland to say, look, why don't we just all be Irish people on this island and strive towards a better society? You don't have to be a Gaelic-speaking peasant from Kerry to be Irish. You can be a working-class Protestant from Belfast and be just as Irish. They're trying to explain the gamut of what it meant to be, or what it could mean to be Irish, and to be, put a positiveness on it. All that type of thing was very, very ideal, given that the state up until the 1980s, the establishment in Northern Ireland thrived on basically pointing out differences between the people so that they could keep them apart, and it's still been successful. I was sort of happy that I now knew which side I was on and which foot to kick with, as we say. When I announced this newly discovered truth to my father, he was less happy, and I think, without being able to describe it, he recognized the sort of doleful, sad, miserable binarism that results from that type of thinking, that exclusive thinking that is basically just decides not to appreciate the nuance of the situation. So for me, this in a way, this journey musically tries to point out that the situation in Northern Ireland and the north of Ireland is complex. It's complex, and its complexity is what makes it, is what should be spoke about all the time, and people should not try to explain that there's two communities in Northern Ireland or in north of Ireland. They should explain that there's one community and that, but it's complex and they relate in very strange ways, informed by history and informed by politics and informed by, well, sectarianism and bad education practice for many, many years. So that's, I think, to say the situation is complex, that's why there's trouble, is much, much, much more correct than to say the situation is binary and simplistic and involves two people with a sense of ethnicity that's very different. I think that's very simple, still used by politicians, and very, very reductive. And I personally don't like it. So by the age of 18 years, I was becoming hooked on traditional Irish dance music and folk song in general. It was something I felt a natural aesthetic affinity with. It was non-sectarian, and it was in a relatively bohemian, non-sectarian environment in the city. The reels and jigs played with gusto in Belfast easily had the same raw appeal as that of the Blood and Thunder bands. So we're getting lots of stuff here now that's, this is more up to date. This is a type of uniforms, that American type of majorette things that that are used today. I'm having to respond to the images here. So that's not typical of the Blood and Thunder bands of the 1980s at all. This is typical of the Blood and Thunder bands of now. And one of the Republican protests against these parades is to throw paint from afar so they destroy these uniforms. So this has become a major source of new. They get money from various funds to buy new uniforms, and some of the Republican community think, well, that's fantastic. We can now throw paint bombs at them. Yes. So when you have a flashpoint, you will get people's throwing paint at these uniform bands. So it's a real. But as you can see, there's a sort of an element of Mardi Gras, you know, and if you're not tuned in, if you didn't know what it was, you might think, well, this is all right. Let's look at the fife and lambeg drum. At least you can see the image. You see what a lambeg drum is, and that'll be good. So that's a parade in a small village in County Derry. And you can see the players are playing fifes. There are one family, the grandfather, two sons, and a grandson. So it's very much passed down in a family, very rural tradition. These drums are not played in Belfast at all. So the Belfast Blood and Thunder Band, or the urban Blood and Thunder Band, is more to do with cities and towns, whereas this is very much a rural tradition. And those were the drums very much that were carried at the 12th, in the 1690. They're a very old thing. They were, until probably 30 years ago, also part of the nationalist tradition as well, in the Hibernian movement. So it wasn't, they weren't only part of the Orange marching tradition. I would really like it, it'd be fantastic if we could hear this, but just for the moment, to see, there's a lot of iconography there, if you look. There's drums, there's sashes. The expert. It's probably something very simple. The marchers were marching with quite fast and a swing. The lambeg drum march is a much more sort of casual thing. The tunes are slower and people sort of saunter. Or to use the vernacular in the north of Ireland and in Ulster generally, in Northern Ireland. Remember, Ulster is more complex. We'll not even go there. Because that includes three counties of the Republic of Ireland in the nationalist psyche. And Ulster in the unionist psyche is six counties. So it's a, again, another area of some form of a Disaccord. So they were playing a tune called The Boys of Belfast, which is a real famous tune, and I'll play it for you with the right timing, and hopefully okay, that sounds good already. Lambeg is a small place beside Lisburn, which is near Belfast. But I mean, the word love bug in the Irish language means small hand, small hand. So it's a, and yet the sort of technique is like this. So it actually, there's not a lot of movement, and all the movement is in the wrist because the drum is so wide. So it's interesting that the town's called Lambeg, the Lambeg drum. So, well, here we are. Have lift off.
Sound.
Okay. Next step. Oh, brilliant. There we have it. A bit more sound. Gives you an idea. A lot of iconography there in the images as well. The young guy is wearing a Glasgow Rangers shirt. One of the Lambeg drummers is wearing a kilt. These are all iconographical of connection with Scotland. So that's let's go back to the third one there. The third one. No, yeah. So that's, you can see the orange plumes. The sort of been for young people from the nationalist background, for example, this is something intimidatory. This would be viewed as intimidatory, particularly if it was going through their areas, which in the 1980s was regular. The police made it possible for these parades to go through areas where they weren't wanted. But just, there's a lot of skill here and things. These people practice in big halls, and they're used to disco music and rock music as part of the scene. And so the pedagogy of this music is also through the vernacular of rock music. So these bands have been getting louder and louder in the last 20 years. And this requires a lot of skill, obviously.
And given it's an expression of British vernacular culture in Northern Ireland, it's very Irish, you know. In another sense, you know, it's a, I mean, the town looks the same as somewhere in County Clare, you know, or whatever, you know, it's not a, it's a, so it's a juxtaposition of paramilitarism and Brazilian Mardi Gras, you know. It's a strange, like, the bodily expression there is, it's almost, it's conflictual in some way. And yet, you know, it's I think it does very much express the vernacular culture of the Blood and Thunder band to young Protestant working class people in Northern Ireland. So that's, I think it's something that needs to be viewed. But in the 1980s, when I looked at this, I couldn't look at it. I decided it was part of something that wasn't anything to do with traditional Irish music. So we can sort of kill it now and see what happens to it. To go back to something different. So. Still there. Yeah. That's the sound in the background, yeah. That's it. Perfect. So we can.
So in retrospect, I was thinking of that to hear real Irish traditional music, I have to go to the place that's regarded as, in folklore circles, as the most authentic, the west of Ireland, Donegal, Sligo, Clare. I have to go to these places if I want to hear old people playing the real music. So for me, even at that time, Belfast or cities, even in Dublin, don't go there for traditional music. Go to the countryside. Get out of the city and go west. Go as far west as you can. And certainly go over the border, because you won't get the real authentic sound of traditional Irish music, you know, in this place. I was wrong, but I mean, that's what I thought then. So it's a metaphorical trip as much as anything else. So I went in search of traditional music in Fermanagh. That's the border county in Northern Ireland, Sligo, Leitrim and Sligo. So in retrospect, it seems that I didn't really have to go very far to hear this music. That's me playing in Washington, D.C. in 2000 with two Lambeg drummers. So just to show you that I do know the repertory, I have an authentic grasp of it, and to prove it, I played music in Washington with two guys who are Lambeg drummers from Belfast and Derry, respectively. So anyway, we'll move on down to the next slide, maybe. And this man is called Tom Gunn. He's a fiddle player from County Fermanagh who lived three streets away from me in Belfast. So he was my first connection with the old traditional music. He worked for the post office. He came home from work every day. I remember I was a friend of his son's, and he would sit in front of the fire, and before he could speak, he had to play tunes on the fiddle. So he took his fiddle out and played tunes. A very complex individual who fought in the British Army in Burma during the Second World War. He was living in England at the time and was conscripted into the British Army. He was an Irish Republican by political outlook, but he fought in the British Army with the Gurkha Rifles in Burma, and received the George Medal for valentry, for bravery in the face of the enemy. A medal which, because of the troubles in Northern Ireland, he hid behind the clock in his house, which would have been, if he'd been a member of the Unionist community, he would have hung it on the hall door, as you would come in, it would be the first thing you've seen. With him, because he was an Irish Republican who'd fought for the British Army, he hid it. And that's not an unusual story, really. It's quite typical. You know, one of the famous graffiti on the first person to get a VC from Belfast in the Second World War was a Catholic from the Falls Road. And it used to be, when "No Pope Here" was written on certain walls of Belfast, One wag at some point wrote, no VCs either, which was a sort of, you know, a retrospect of some sort of get back at situation. So you have this double-edged sword all the time. Tommy Gunn, you know, a recognized hero of the British Army during the Second World War, and an Irish Republican, you know, who played the fiddle and, you know, wanted United Ireland. You know, so this is a sort of... Anyway, let's hear Tommy, if we can, singing a song. If you could, maybe I'll have to do it here. If I can do it from this. This is him lilting a reel. I wonder if it'll come through in this now. So he was a very happy man, given he'd been through the war and he was shell-shocked and couldn't hear very well. Okay, I'm going to pause him. He could dance, he could sing, he could lilt. That expression there is known as lilting. It's just mouth music. And I took great pleasure in learning tunes on the flute from people singing them to me, because when they do that, they lilt. There's a lot of aesthetic information in that. There's triplets, there's lots of stuff going on that you can impose on your playing. So that's Tom Gunn playing the fiddle. He plays the fiddle as well, but there he was lilting. I kept on travelling. He's, if you think of him, symbolic of County Fermanagh. I travelled on into County Leitrim over the border into the Republic of Ireland and met people who were still playing this old music. The social reality was at the heart of the aesthetic of this form of music making. People welcomed you into their circle of music. Come and sit down. If you could play one tune, you were welcome. You know, so they were very, very welcome. And my first impression as a sort of baby musician that could play three or four tunes, arriving in County Fermanagh, arriving in County Leitrim and Sligo, is that these older guys and older women, and older people in general, wanted you, they were very happy that you could play and you were interested, that you were somebody from Belfast coming down to meet them. They were just thrilled and they brought you into their houses. They, you know, give you food, put you up, a lot. Very, very kind people. And I think that's one of the reasons why I got very much involved in it as well. So I was welcomed by many of the people, treated without ceremony as one of them. It seemed that what for Man of Fiddler, Tommy Gunn, who you've just seen there, had said at the start, one of my first musical mentors in Belfast, was spot on when he pointed out that if you can play a few tunes, you'll be all right. It's from Tommy that I learned my first bits of music. So I think I'll just, we've lost a bit of time, so you know, I'll try and jump forward a bit and get to stuff that's more reflective. So move on to the next thing, perhaps. That's a map of Sligo and Leitrim. So if you can see how that works. This, to my mind, was like a geographical representation of the place I wanted to hang out in and go around little villages. My impression was, you go to the old musicians, they're the ones who've got the old aesthetic that's less influenced by, you know, modern sounds and modern music. And, you know, I think, yeah, it's the right thing to do, except that in terms of their singing, in terms of their references, they were very often completely... they referred to their youth rather than old times. They referred to, you know, songs that were popular when they were teenagers or in their early 20s. So they weren't, when they were asked to sing, I remember one of the musicians I asked to sing, Peter Horan, I think. and this man here, Peter Welsh. They played these old tunes and reels and jigs, but when it came to songs, they very often sung songs from the 1950s, which would be about whenever they were young. So you'd expect a traditional song from... I was interested in songs from the child ballads, Irish versions of songs that dated from the 15th, 16th century. And I was hoping to, I was assuming that these old musicians would sing old, ancient songs, but no. They sung pop songs from the 1950s, mostly. So you'd have this traditional music, which is maybe 18th century, late 18th century, some of the older tunes, 19th century, and the songs were very much up to date. The Indian Love Call and various things that were unexpected, to my mind unexpected, but in retrospect, perfectly correct. So let me hear some. This man, Peter Welsh, when I went to see him, had really stopped playing the flute, and he just played a tune for me after, I think, a 15-year gap in playing. So he wasn't really in top form, but he told me a lot and talked about music and said how the flute was the instrument of choice for the people in this his townland of Tubbercurry in the early part of the 20th century and when he was young. So I was trying to get by. What is the aesthetic? What is the sound that people are looking for? Because it certainly wasn't the classical music round tone of, you know. Just little, wasn't that? It was something much more rough and ready. And I wonder what sort of instruments did they use? What the type of instruments they used would obviously influence the type of sound they made. And he talked about instruments being made out of fuaran, which is Gaelic being sort of hogweed or long grass, and spokes of cartwheels and all sorts of stuff that was lying around. Flutes were very simple to make, in contrast to fiddles or ilan pipes, which required an investment of money. So the flute, in fact, was regarded as a pretty much low down the social world scale. It was the bottom feeder of the traditional music world because it was simple, the technology was simple. And even when people got instruments that were modelled on 19th century classical instruments, they still played them in the old way. Most of the older players just took these keys off and blocked them up and played the way, just played in keys that were amenable, that you didn't have to work on. So O'Neill says in 1913, no musical instrument was in such common use among the Irish peasantry as the flute. From the penny whistle to the keyed instrument in sections, it was always deservedly popular, for unlike the fiddle and the bagpipe, it involved no expense beyond the purchase price. So O'Neill added that fluters seldom took to the road and that only conspicuous excellence would give them any notice at all in the community. So this guy must have been good. He was good in his youth. We'll see if we can play some of Peter now. Very unhurried, and you can't imagine it being people dancing rapidly. A more typical style now, that if you go to Ireland and go into a pub and listen to somebody playing a reel, it'll be more like this. Very, very nervous, very fast. Where the way Peter was playing there was elongating notes, taking time. And he said that in the context of the small dances in houses, where there was maybe four people dancing, the dancers reacted to the musician, the musician reacted to them. So they slowed down, the musician slowed down. If the musician maybe played a bit louder, faster, the dancers would respond. So in the sort of older way, the older context of music, of traditional music in Ireland, there was a complicity between dancers and music. And that was something which I, in the cities, was less common at the time. You know, it was less, it was a session in a city generally didn't have any connection with dance, in my experience. And it still is the case that traditional music in a pub, you've got to go to a ceilidh now, and it's big, and the music is very fast, and people are dancing, and they've got Adidas bags, you know, they're very much, it's like a sport, like an occasion which combines art and sport. And in fact, the Minister of Art and Sport in the Republic of Ireland is the same thing, which I find that a bit strange, but nonetheless, that's art and sport are lumped together. So, but the ceilidh dancing of today and the set dancing is very much, very sporty, very demands a lot of to be fit and vital. So, Peter pointed out to me that when he could play and old people would dance, would get up and shuffle about, and there would still be the artistic element of the music interspersed with the dance was very much to the fore. So there's a conflict between something being art and sport. I find there's a conflict, and I think that reference to Peter Welsh for me explains it a little bit, you know, that dance music is not necessarily something you've got to be as fit as an Olympic runner to do, you know? So, or shouldn't be anyway. So that's let me move on to the next slide, please, Anne-Catherine. This is a character that I met as well. I'll just say something about styles as well, and flights of fancy, because music, when you play music, I think you do involve your imagination or an imaginary in much the same way as people might write a book. If you know the books that employ magical realism, for example, you know that jump around from one century to another, or one context to another, and things appear to be superimposed or running sort of consecutively. Music, I think, works in much the same way. So when you play music, you're inspired by an actuality, but you're also inspired by an imaginary. So I already had in my head that I'm going somewhere mysterious, and I'm going to meet bardic apostles, you know, over in Sligo and Leitrim, people that live in a sort of like some form of, you know, high priest type of world, you know, that was very mystical. So in a way, even though that wasn't the truth and everybody's three-dimensional, it's still part of an imaginary that is brought into being in the process of interpreting music, or being, if you like, imposing or not, or funneling your art through a particular genre. That's a way of describing it. So, when I first reflect on my search for what I call the raw bar of flute music, the raw sound in the west of Ireland, I recall my first visit to Drum Shambo in County Leitrim. This is like to explain this analogy to magical realism, as something that was so good that maybe it didn't really happen, that it was already, I'd planned it in advance, so what I looked at, I wasn't really seeing. I was seeing with my mind's eye from another situation. Was it a dreamlike imagining, or was it a random connection with a piece of publicity from the tourist board that I'd heard on the radio, along with the news of President Kennedy's assassination? Or did I really find myself in a pub in the company of a policeman, but I think this is true, buying pints for musicians at midnight, and no less than three flute players and several boron players, drum players, holding forth with music and tall stories well into the early hours of the morning. To this day, I can't be sure, but it was a sort of an epiphany, if you like. And I don't want to spoil it by putting names and dates on it. I could do that for you. But if I do that, then I'm going to ruin it for myself. Just take it that it probably happened or didn't happen. So I suppose I should move on a bit, because how are we for time?
Yes, if you want us to have questions.
Yes, I do want you to have questions. Let's talk about the style. There's an assumed style of different geographical regions, that Leitrim is a style, Sligo is a style, Clare is a style. Belfast has now got a style of flute playing. It's up for grabs and up for chat. And certainly conceptions of geopolitical, geographical, geocultural space comes into that conception of musical style. And that's more or less getting read of the next two pages. So I'll finish up with a few just comments on the end of it here. And then I can play or illustrate as best I can. For me, this last player here we should listen to is called Jim Donoghue, and he's playing a tin whistle. You can see it in his hand here. It's a Clark C tin whistle. You can see a blurred outline of it. It's a whistle played like this. And Jim used to work on it to get a sound that was special, very loud. And he generally just stayed in one octave, but he wanted to make a lot of sound. And he always just played this whistle. And his sound, I think, is reminiscent of just an older aesthetic of music. So we'll maybe finish with just him and say that for me, looking for this old musical knowledge firsthand was part of a necessary journey that I had to make. Now, I've made other musical journeys since, so I'm not one-dimensional. So everyone has their own formative pantheon of experiences. And this trip from Belfast to Sligo and the West and everything in between is one of mine. I know that the musicians and the music that I've presented to you here today, the bands, the individuals, have affected my sonic imaginary, the way I hear things, and that this has a vital impact on my approach to making music. These extraordinary individuals, who I had the pleasure of knowing, just a few of them there, like Jim and John Blessing, who I didn't hear, and who Jim Donoghue were going to play, and Peter Welsh, were above all generous, were witty, they enjoyed a joke, they were good-humoured people. And this is what drew me to them, just as much as the music they play. So in a way, this folk and traditional music thing, there's a huge social aesthetic there as well. There's a huge baggage, social baggage with it, that's very user-friendly. It's very walk in and be there. There's very little ritual involved, even though there, of course, there's a ritual, but it's not an obvious one. So if you were antisocial, they wouldn't like you. Now, if you went in there scowling at them, they would tell you where to go. But it's a very social world, so it's very important to be sociable, to be open to people, because that was the musical world that they came to. So that really drew me to traditional music and to drew me to folk music. It was a world where, to use a well-worn yet accurate platitude, life and art are one and the same. And with that little statement, maybe we'll just listen to Jim Donoghue and then invite you to ask any questions you like that pertain to my little talk, or that pertain to it directly or indirectly. I don't mind. There's a baron playing with him here, drum. He's playing a jig, it's slower than the reed. Thank you.
you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, everyone.
And if there are any questions, you're more than welcome to them. Yes, Alexandra.
It's such a pleasure to welcome you back here. So,
thank you.
I actually left some students at the time. I'm only teaching you half an hour today. I'm to listen to this. I was wondering about regional styles.
Yes.
Is it a case of original styles that used to be distinctive and that became kind of homogenized because of people traveling? Is there an element of that?
There's an element of that, and I think there's also an element of, you know, whenever the Irish traditional music started to be mediatized in the late, the early part of the 20th century, in the 1920s and 30s, mostly in the States with labels like His Master's Voice and various recording concerns in Chicago and New York for the most part, where recordings were made of Irish immigrants, basically, who played music. A lot of these recordings started to come back, and I think that's where styles started to be talked about. That's where the homogenization started, I think. And in Sligo style, because it was, for some reason, Sligo musicians and fiddle players in particular, because technically, apparently, with the old recording technology, fiddles and stringed instruments were easier to record than other instruments. You could use a strobe violin and record it on wax cylinders. So the very earliest recordings of instruments are stringed. So a lot of these players played, they recorded tunes, and they came back to Ireland on 78s, you know, whenever discs became invented and diffused. And that became owning a record player and being able to play to your neighbours. You're another neighbour who emigrated to the States 10 years ago, and he came back, listen to this. It's like frying eggs, but nonetheless, it was the idea, the prestige of that musician who'd gone abroad and came back on this packaged icon. So that was the beginning of, if you like, the Sligo style and the Sligo music becoming some sort of a marker for Irish traditional music generally, subsequently, but regional style, I think it's to do with that. I mean, the Sligo style that I grew up with, my understanding of Sligo, just to give you an example, the people that I listened to were people like Seamus Tansey, and who came to, were starting to tour and come to Belfast and Dublin and play. They didn't play at all like Peter Welsh. Peter was playing very slowly and with long notes, and he is a Sligo flute player. Whereas I heard it like more like this. Fast and sort of exciting. And one of the theories about that is that the immigrant musicians who subsequently influenced the local musicians who didn't move, the 78 recordings were done, and they were performing to a very eclectic international audience. They were trying to make Irish music appeal to people from Ukraine and everywhere, basically. So they were playing to a multicultural audience, and they were, so all the sort of exciting elements of the music were being emphasized. So that had an effect on the way people received it and played it. So that's one thing, but there still is a conception that, oh, Sligo music's like this, such and such is like this, such and such area. But it's a lot to do with individual creativity and individual approaches as to how you play it. To my mind, that's more important. But I think that the idea of regional style is a good imaginary. It's an important for the imaginary, you know, to go off and say, well, I'm playing Sligo music. I'm County Clare's notorious. You know, people from County Clare reckon there's nobody else in Ireland can play music like them, that's it. So if you want to listen to Irish music, you go to County Clare, forget about the rest. Just go to Clare and stay there. So it's tongue-in-cheek, it's good-humoured, and there is particularly good music in Clare. They're right about that. for some, for you know, but so there's areas which are more, I suppose, there's more activity, generally speaking, in traditional music. Once you go west, there's more. Maybe it's because, I think, as Edmund Ardner once pointed out, there's a theory of event density. You know, that if you're in a city, there's so many things going on, you've got a choice. So if you're in a little village nearby a big city, and there's one thing happening, that thing becomes, well, same things happen here all the time. Look, this is happening. So in a way, when you go to the west of Ireland, to a small village, and you find a village, find people playing music, it's very lively, it's very much, and it's, you're focused, because that's the event that's happening. Does that make sense a bit? It's about the country person walking out their door. They walk out their front door, the world is their oyster. You know, the person in the city of center of Paris walks out their door, and the next four streets is their world. You know, I don't know if that's true, or if people think that way, but there's a certain, if you live in a big metropolis, you've got a lot to think about before you even you leave that city. Paris would be a very good example of that, I think. So that's, I suppose, something to say about styles and regional styles as opposed to individual creativity.
Other questions?
Something about the title. Can you explain the word lump sum, but not really real? Because I looked up in the dictionary earlier today.
What did you get?
It said something about Scottish typical dance or something. Scottish.
Oh, what dictionary did you look into? Yeah. We'll have to investigate
online,
that.
Like, reference or
was it Lancers, perhaps, you looked up?
I don't remember. But that was, yeah, real, with the same spelling, and it was, yes, yeah. Scottish.
I was surprised. I've never heard the word used in Scotland. That's not to say it can't be, but I've heard it used in Ireland regularly.
How would you define it in a few words? Real.
Well, I think what I said at the start, a lonesome reel is to something. Okay, I'll try and play you one, right? I'll play you a lonesome reel. Because the one who was playing there isn't so lonesome. It's sort of happy. Here's a happy one. A straightforward happy one. Describe that as lonesome. I would describe that as vital, happy, uplifting. I would describe this one as lonesome, but can you tell me why?
A fast
dance piece. So both those tunes that I played there could be danced to. They're dance music.
Okay.
And you might get people moving at the same speed, but one of them would be recognized by people familiar with the genre as more lonesome than the other. Now, I thought, well, it must be something to do with, in the Western art descriptors, you know, minor, harmonic minor, melodic minor, and major. You know, but it's not. It's not that, you know. It's modal. It conforms more to the sort of like the, you know, the modes, the sort of Aeolian, Ionian, these sort of slightly older conception of tonal relationships. And I think a lonesome reel is usually in the Ionian mode. It's not quite the same tone, semitone in a major scale, or it isn't the same as the harmonic minor. It's like a starting on a note, and it has a a relationship is a bit arbitrary. And that turns out as a lonesome thing, you see. But so it's not minor or major in the Western art sense. But it has a sort of a feeling of, it's not unhappy either, because it's pacey. And it's, if it was a slow air, it might be just sad. But because it's fast and pacey, it's rhythmic, it's not sad. So it's lonesome.
Because you said you're trying to avoid to put ethnic labels on your music, but then would you then describe, like, how would you describe the music that you're playing? Would you, like, base it purely on the sound or on geographical areas?
Well, I mean, you can be very clear about the repertoire, for example. I mean, that tune I played you, that tune there, The Lonesome Reel, that I just played you, is called Follow Me Up to Carlow. Carlow is a town in Ireland. So you can sort of get, well, okay, something to do with Carlow. Another tune is called The Boys of Ballisadare. There's another one of the tunes that I played. Ballisadare is a town in Sligo. So there, you can know that they're Irish, they're tunes that were composed by someone in Ireland because of the local names. Not in every case. They can also talk about states of mind or people. You know, like Kate's favourite, or the humours of Ballycastle, or the humours can be used in that Shakespearean sense. If you're familiar with Shakespeare and the different sort of emotions, the humours, it's like you're talking about a state of mind, and I'm somebody referring to a place or an experience in that place. So a lot of the names of the tunes will tell you that they're ethnically Irish. But the actual music itself, you know, the music can stand for itself. You know, very often when I play in circumstances, it's always described as Irish music, you know. It's fair enough. But I mean, I wouldn't like my music to be attractive to people simply because it's Irish. You know, I'd want a bit more. That it's, you know, you're expressing yourself as a musician first and foremost. So there is that conflict in folk and traditional music from any country between being an expression of ethnicity and an expression of artistic creativity. There's a tension because, and folk music in particular has it. I suppose you could say 18th century art music has it as well. It's about Austria and it's about Western art. It's about big courts and stuff like that. And it's a soundscape that talks about power. So you could, you know, it's a good question, but I think that ethnicity and traditional music, yes, they are. They're lumped together, and it's an easy way of talking about this is Chinese music, this is Irish music, this is blah blah. Here it is. This characterizes it. But you're not saying anything about the person who's playing it, the instrument they're using, or what they think of it, or what other people in their supposed cultural world think of what they do. So I mean, I think there's a tension in folk music between describing it as an ethnic expression and an artistic endeavor. Does that go in some way towards answer? I hope so.
Perhaps the last question among the public. Yes, Bertrand.
Marching bands still gather a lot of young people, don't they?
They certainly do.
We could guess they wouldn't be so popular or as popular as in the past, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
It's actually, you know, in terms of the working class unionist population of Northern Ireland, and they are more popular than ever.
But what motivates?
Just because it's a cultural identity, to feel part of this British Ulster identity.
Yeah.
And that's a folk music expression of that. That's playing your identity, your Britishness, you know? Even though the tunes they use, I mean, that marching band, we play dum 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 dum, was the first tune they played. That's a tune from Newcastle upon Tyne, where I lived for the last 12 years, called the Keel Row. So it's just a folk tune from England. And they followed that with a tune called the Freeze Breeches, which is a famous Irish jig that they just turned into a march rhythm. So their inspiration comes from without, if you like, from a political cultural world that they would deny has any influence on what they do. So, you know, it's in spite of itself, it's very much an Irish tradition, and the lambeg drum and fifing is an Irish tradition. It's not found anywhere else in Britain. It's a very much an Irish tradition, but it's very specific to Ulster. But the thing is that you will find lambeg drumming in County Monaghan, which is the most northerly county of the Republic of Ireland, because there are unionist communities in those border counties still. So it's, you know, there's a conflict in how Ulster is described. There's a political Ulster, and then there's an older entity which is more sort of geo-cultural. I know it's a hard one for me to even get talk about and to conceive of as important, but it sort of is, because there's a lot of iconography there and thought, a way of processing that geocultural information that could lend itself to, you know, at least symbolic fusions or symbolic peace in the future. There's lots of stuff now that symbols are very important in Northern Ireland, the north of Ireland. Symbols are very important. Flags, sounds, sound icons, very important still. But if people understood the sort of the history of these symbols and just teased it out like a piece of spaghetti from a plate, they're left with not certainty, but uncertainty. And the uncertainty of that is the reality of cultural development and cultural change. Mm. And if people, I think if people have a concept of that, there's less place for sectarianism, there's less place for binarisms. So I'm somebody that prefers to view things as complex rather than simple. And the way to explain things to people is to actually be as complex as you like. You know, take a tune. I could go into a unionist community with a tune that they play and the marching bands and explain to them that it probably comes from County Cork. I mean, I'll give you one just as a little musical example. This is the same tune where I live now in Limerick, in County Limerick, in the Republic of Ireland. I live in the city of Limerick. This tune is known as the Battle Hymn of Munster. And people say it's a very old tune, going right back to, you know, the 16th century. So as it goes out. To a unionist community and said, that is the Battle Hymn of Munster. They will soon tell me it's not. It's called the 12th of July in the Morning. It's exactly the same tune. It's been appropriated for different geopolitical reasons, but it's the same tune coming from the same cultural bank. But a lot of those old tunes are taken, shaken, and appropriated for political use. Many of you, you know, so it's. I think those things explained can't be talked about in the context of Northern Ireland and the next Brexit impasse that we're coming to. They understand the reality of cultural process and how things are shared rather than sort of pulled apart. It's just an important debate to have, not just in universities and schools, except but just publicly all the time, so that this type of thinking diffuses. Because I think it has a potential to defuse potentially violent situations somewhere along the line. Not to put too grand a sort of slant on it, but I do think it's important to discuss these things about geocultural space, sonic ways of hearing things, way of interpreting things, and given genuine hard information that's in books, in secondary sources, and folklore sources to explain why people play the same tunes but call them different names and appropriate use them in different circumstances.
Well, thank you very much, Daisy, again. I think that time is drawing to an end and we'll have to vacate the room. So thanks very much again.
You're very welcome.